The Musician's Musician Podcast is brought to you by you. For real. We rely on listener donations to grow the show, so if you'd like to support what we do, you can set up a one-time or recurring donation. Just follow the link in the description. It's super easy, because PayPal. A huge thanks to those of you who have already given. We also want to ask if you could be so kind as to rate and subscribe to the program on whatever platform you use to listen to us. It helps the show reach more ears, and we love your feedback. Okay, on to the show. So, Max, how's that blazing Texas heat?
You know, it's I spend a lot of time indoors. And so the few times I do go outside, it's actually pretty nice.
Nice.
That being said, I did grow up in the Middle East.
Yeah, this is easy.
Yeah.
Small potatoes.
Yeah, this is nothing. But but I also don't go outside much. If I had to like work outside all day, this would be the worst.
Absolutely. Well, the heat has nothing to do with who we're talking about today, but did just want to provide some temporal frame of reference, I suppose. The Texas heat wave that is ongoing.
You're just glad you're not here?
Very glad that I don't live there anymore. Yes, I think about that often. No offense to you Texans. By any means.
I'm not a Texan. I just live here.
Fair enough. But in preparation for this episode, it did get me thinking about grad school, actually, of all things.
That has nothing to do with Texas.
Yeah. So when I was in grad school, I had the opportunity to do a lot of teaching. I taught a number of courses while I was in grad school, but something that was really important to my advisor was for me and my counterpart to have some hands-on experience with what, you know, the administrative side of being affiliated with the university looks like. So, which meant that we were doing a lot of the, you know, bureaucracy things. We were working with, you know, marketing departments, and it often meant that we were working with guest artists who would come to the university, and that was one of the benefits that we did have. So one time we did have an artist who was of a status that was one where they typically wouldn't do some sort of educational outreach with the students. Oftentimes, you know, if a jazz program brings in an artist, it's not uncommon for them to do a workshop or a masterclass with the students. But usually if it's a big name, they don't do that. There are exceptions, and I have seen some exceptions, but typically they're not doing that sort of thing. But because I was a grunt for the university I was at, you know, we were schlepping this group around, and I did actually get to have dinner with the Brad Meldow trio, which was, you know, I've been trying to think of a comparison for people who aren't interested in the space, like what it's like to meet somebody of that status. There are a lot of very famous people that I would absolutely never give a shit to meet if the opportunity present itself. But for somebody like Brad Meldow to have the opportunity to have some one-on-one time, that was a huge deal for me, because he has been a hero of mine for years. Like, really, as long as I've been interested in jazz music, you know, Brad Meldow's a hero. And I'm not alone in that. But, you know, they always say to never meet your heroes, and this was an exception to that. He was a very kind person. He was very, you know, gracious in answering our questions. And I will say Larry Grenadier and Jeff Ballard, who were his bandmates that evening, were a lot of fun. Very eccentric people. So anyway, but there's a reason that people think about Brad Meldow this way. People like me and people who are fans of this type of music hold Brad Meldow up in a super, super high regard. And he is on this pedestal that so many people, particularly younger people who are getting into improvised music, really, really look up to in a huge way.
Well, I'd say even like I've heard people say that Brad Meldow is arguably, and some would argue pretty hard for this, that he's the best jazz pianist alive, or at least in this era.
Sure.
And
well, that I will say, you know, that gets pretty controversial, which we'll we'll talk about why that I will mention why that is for a couple of different reasons, but you're not wrong. I mean, he is mentioned in that way though, like,
yeah,
often.
Pretty frequently.
yeah
Brad Meldow is one of those guys that just like has there's really something special about his music.
Yeah.
And it's one of his albums I listened to every night. Like, you can't listen to the whole thing every night because you like fall asleep, which is the point, you know, but like of, you know, of it being nighttime, but listen to part of that album every night for probably at least a year.
Mm.
And it never got old.
Yeah.
Like, I still listen to that album. There's so much good stuff, and he's constantly not reinventing himself, but just pulling more influence in and developing. Like, there are many artists that have ceased to progress in a variety of ways, and Brad Meldow is one of the artists who has not ceased to progress in not just his technical skill level and, you know, as a piano player, but as a composer and as someone who's pulling in influence from even more and more and more places.
Yeah.
So, and that's a philosophy we'll get into later, but he's an incredible, incredible musician that, frankly, we're pretty darn stoked to be talking about today.
Yeah. He's been on our list since the beginning. He's been kind of one of the guys we've been
absolutely
really waiting to talk about, and we'll get into why that is. We're gonna focus a bit more on, you know, his philosophical underpinnings and the musical side of things as opposed to the bio in this one, just because he is one of those figures who has written a lot, and there's tons of interview information that we've been able to pull from that, and there is so much recorded information to sort through that we can, there's just a lot to talk about with the music. So we're really big fans. It's good. We're going to have to rein it in a lot with this one, but let's get into talking about Brad Meldow.
So our story starts in Jacksonville, Florida, 1970, August 23rd. Brad Meldow was born Bradford Alexander Meldow. And he was adopted actually pretty early on in his life, before the age of five, it would seem. And his adoptive family lived in Georgia, and by the time he was five, had moved to New Hampshire. He wasn't in a musical family in the sense that his parents were musicians, but it seems that they were a musical family in the sense of being appreciators. He talks about always having a piano in the home, and he talks about listening to the radio a lot, particularly talking about his latest album, which is all Beatles music. He talks about listening to a lot of these really important Beatles songs on the radio, and in conjunction with a lot of the other pop music that was on the radio. And he does have a love for various musics, including pop music, which, you know, whatever that actually means.
Yeah.
So, but he started playing piano when he was young, and, by the time he was 10, they'd moved to Connecticut, and, he really got it that up until this point, he had been playing like a lot of kind of like standard stuff that you learn as a child learning how to play piano. But at this point he starts getting into classical music, and that's something we'll see continue to come into his life in various significant ways. in his music. But by the time he's a teenager, he's getting into jazz, and there are a lot of really important players that he's listening to. And one of the formative albums that he was gifted as a teenager was Smoking at the Half Note, and that was just super important for him. So he's playing, he's like getting into jazz, playing it, being involved in kind of like all the normal ways, like plays in the school jazz band in high school. But he starts gigging, kind of gets like a residency, like with a weekly gig at a club, plays all sorts of other types of gigs. But he really has settled on music being his path, and is really, really pursuing it. I feel like it seems like in all the ways that you can as a teenager. He did end up getting Berklee College of Music's Best All-Round Musician Award that they give out for musicians that are of that age group. But he keeps kind of doing this thing until he goes to college. And this is 1988. He goes to the New School in New York City. And we've talked about the New School a bunch. There are a bunch of really cool players that have been through there that we have talked about in the past and that we will talk about in the future. But one of the really important things for Brad Meldow was getting to New York City. And this put him in the place to like really, I feel like really put down or get like the nourishment he needed to get to the next level. One of those things that he got was studying from Fred Hirsch, who was a really important teacher for him. And that influences his solo playing, but also, you know, his ability to pull in different influences and put things together in different ways than he had previously been doing, which, you know, fusion, not like jazz fusion,
right,
but like fusing genres is a really important thing for Brad, and I think a trademark of his music. But he studied with and also started playing with Jimmy Cobb, who is a very important drummer. And he was also playing with Peter Bernstein, who we will do an episode on at some point. He's a phenomenal guitar player, kind of doing like an organ trio-ish thing. But he's at this point during his college years, so like 1988 to 1993, he is doing like the full musician thing. Like he's studying it in school, but he's playing a bunch of live gigs. He's touring Europe even. Recording. I mean, he's really diving in headfirst and being very successful at it, at that. He's playing with multiple groups. He played with Joshua Redman. There's a lot of really cool stuff that's going on, and this kind of sets the trajectory for what's to come. So once he graduates, 1993, he starts playing with Larry Grenadier and Jorge Rossi. And this is a trio that is going to be really important to him, for him, perhaps to him as well. I could not speak to that. But he plays, he does a number of albums with them. And those are called the Art of the Trio. And there's like five albums with that. And trio work is really kind of one of the things that got, I guess I would say that Brad Meldow is most known for. He really thrives in a trio setting. And I mean, you hear it. There's like a lot of really cool stuff that's going on, that he's able to explore with that. But, He ends up moving to Los Angeles in 1996, and this he had had quite a bit of experience with drugs and particularly heroin, and had moved to LA to try and get out of that. And to my understanding, he was successful. I don't know necessarily when, but was able to kick that. But he is extremely busy. I mean, to put it lightly, he's working a ton. He's getting lots of notoriety. He's playing festivals. He's recording albums. He's really, at this point, he's made quite a name for himself in the jazz scenes, I guess. He's playing on film soundtracks. He's doing a lot of really cool stuff, and is he keeps finding ways to incorporate new influences that he values into his music. And I'm not going to get deeper into that, because I feel like that's much more a conversation for his philosophies. But he's been in or around Amsterdam for unless he's moved in the last couple of years, for about a little over 10 years or so, and still does a lot in New York, but is also touring all over the world. So he's not quite like a Pino Palladino level touring guy, yeah. but is on the road quite a bit, playing different things and working with different people. So there's a ton going that has gone on, and it seems like he's not slowing down at all. He keeps putting out records pretty consistently, in trios, as solo, you know, in various different projects that all kind of have their own fingerprint. And it's been really pretty fun to see what he's going to come up with next, because it's always fresh and interesting.
Right. So to, you know, bring all that together and be thinking about the music that was influencing him in his early years, but is continuing to be influential on him, when he discovered jazz and was getting really deep into that, you know, an easy place to kind of pick from is to mention Keith Jarrett. Many people think of Brad Meldow as sort of a, you know, a post Keith Jarrett sort of pianist, which we'll talk a little bit about what we mean by that later, because it kind of gets into the hairiness of what we're going to call jazz and what we're not going to call jazz. But you know, also references Wynton Kelly, who was on Smoking at the Half Note, and McCoy Tyner, both of whom are, you know, needless to say, if you know anything about jazz history, you're very familiar with both of those pianists. Also, as you mentioned, classical music's really important to him. Particularly Brahms, he mentions as being hugely influential, but also Schumann and Schubert. We will also talk about why that is later. There are specific reasons for those influences. But then there are also his contemporaries who he regards as being heavily influential on him, much like a lot of people who we've talked about are influenced by their peers. So is Brad Meldow. Specifically, he mentions people he met when he first moved to New York, who you mentioned already, Peter Bernstein. Also, Larry Goldings and Kevin Hayes are a couple of keyboard piano players who he mentions as being very important to him. Joshua Redman, we have to mention him again. He played with him a lot and has played with him a lot since. Joshua Redman's like a mega star in the jazz world as well. But also, you know, his teachers like Fred Hirsch or Kenny Werner, and you know, guys who he was seeing in New York a lot, like Cedar Walton and Kenny Barron, who are a couple that he mentions as well. But yeah, a lot of different things going on musically, but there's a strong focus on like the German Romantic school that has to be noted. Like, put a thumbtack in that German Romantic school. And then like a lot of these bebop and post-bop piano players. All of this is super, super important. And when we talk about music in a few minutes, you know, we'll talk about technically why that is. But before that, let's talk about some of the philosophical underpinnings of Brad Meldow.
So when we're talking about like the philosophical, I guess, aspects of Brad Meldow and his playing, I kind of want to maybe I'll just tackle the elephant in the room. He talks about there not being just one style. And he's like, why can't I be really strong in multiple styles? And he definitely has this philosophy of having a wide variety of influences and drawing on all of them. And that is everything like from the Romantic era music you talked about, the bebop. He's very, very interested in a lot of pop music, rock music. He's covered Stone Temple Pilots, you know, which seemingly doesn't make any sense, but he does it incredibly.
Yeah.
So, there's so much in there, and he's worked with a ton of different, like, you know, working with Mark Juliana on some stuff that's like very outside of jazz,
yeah,
but also very in it too. So, I just think that's one of the things that's really important to and about him is that nothing is sacred in the sense that there is no merit in keeping something pure for the sake of it being pure.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I think I think that's one of the things that you hear, like, particularly as you go through his discography too, because like he'll spend time in specific things. He'll like work on something for an album, and then as you keep going into his discography, you hear things. I mean, sometimes it's like a very overt, we are staying in this camp right now.
Yeah.
But when he plays solo or like is kind of given more creative freedom, like, you can hear it all, and it just gets more and more. He's just got a bigger and bigger bag of tricks to pull from.
Well, that's not to mention too that there's plenty of albums of his that are very much what you could consider to be classical music, right? Like there's an album, yeah, of his that came out very recently called The Folly of Desire. That's piano and vocal, but like in a classical setting, right? Yeah, there's a lot of other things that we could touch on here without, you know, falling into too many digressions. One thing that I do like that he talks about is something that happens in the jazz community oftentimes, as we've mentioned in many other episodes, is you end up playing with a lot of different people. And that's kind of one of the great things about jazz music, is you can do that because you're pulling from a shared foundational language. But he talks about the value that he pulls in sticking with a group and developing a rapport with the same people, which is why, you know, his trio, the trio that people think about, there's the one with Jorge Rossi and Larry Grenadier, and then in 2005 Jorge was replaced by Jeff Ballard, but Larry Grenadier was still the bass player. But those have been his two main groups. Like, that's it for the last almost 30 years. So to say he's developed a strong rapport with these people is absolutely an understatement. The other thing I want to mention, there's a lot of different places we could go. But one other thing I do want to mention is that he talks about the importance of developing your own voice early on. So again, with jazz music, it's so important to dig into the tradition, understand who the great players were, being able to emulate them, understanding what the language is. Again, all things we've talked about ad nauseum. But he does not shy away from saying, even in the midst of that, while you are digging deep into that, you still want to be able to sit at your instrument and just organically develop a relationship with it. Like, yes, have this osmosis sort of thing happen with this really important lineage, but you also need to be just developing an organic voice that is you and the piano. And he talks about that being something that's always been really important for him, is letting all these different influences, whether it's, you know, Beatles or Radiohead or Brahms or any of the jazz greats that we've mentioned, all of this kind of just ends up coming out in the way that it does. And I don't think that always works for all people, but when we listen to Brad Meldow, it makes a lot of sense that all of that is sort of spewing out the other end.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that he said is, I think another aspect of finding your own voice on the instrument, he says the older he gets, the more he values trying to get a beautiful sound out of the instrument.
Mm.
And I think the touch that Brad Meldow has on the piano is just, I don't believe it gets really better than that.
there is a lot to be said there, no question.
Yeah, he definitely has his own voice in just like not the types of licks he uses and the styles he likes, but like also the touch that he has on the instrument. And everyone has that to a degree, but
yeah,
I just really like Brad's take on it.
Well, there are plenty of other points we could probably dive into, but with those last two points, I think that's a great bridge into getting into talking about the actual music and playing of Brad Meldow.
So when we get started into the style and we talk about the different instrumentations that Brad's going to be working in, there's a lot. And I'll just kind of cover the corner cases first, perhaps. He's like playing with like just one other person sometimes, and that could be a vocalist, that could be just a drummer, that could be, I mean, any number of things. But sometimes he does work with a larger band, sometimes as a leader, but that's a lot of times more as a sideman. When like a lot more of his sideman work is in the greater than three people ensemble size. However, he also has worked with orchestras. There are few instrumentations that he hasn't done. He's done, we talked about, organ trio, in previous episodes. He's done some of that, which is kind of our gateway into his normal, I guess, more common, more frequented instrumentations.
Yeah.
And that is the trio, the classic jazz piano trio of piano, bass, and drums, and then also playing as a solo performer. And those two are what he's done the lion's share of his work on. It's a lot easier to move around with fewer people, but he seems to really thrive creatively in those spaces, because he'll work with these other groups and then come and bring that back to his trio or bring that back to his solo playing. And he's very much one of those players that can really go in and do anything. And we've seen him do tons and tons and tons of different things. Cause he'll write for a variety of different, ensemble, types, but, we're going to stick mostly in that camp. And what we'll talk about with his sound is mostly his solo playing, and trio sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
However, those principles will apply to other things too. So, yeah. And when we talk about like the piano, I got the impression that he is a Steinway artist. I didn't know if I wanted to read that far into it, because I don't know that I didn't look up on Steinway's website to see if they like sponsored him like that. Like guitars, you know, it's like, oh yeah, we're anyway.
Yeah, I think they kind of do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there was some stuff on YouTube about it, but he talking about like the, he'll talk about like the, what is it? Kind of the shortcomings of the piano. Mm. And like someone that's like very, very intimately familiar with their instrument will know the things, the shortcomings of it. And, you know, says that Steinway does a better job of like overcoming those. Yeah. And,
nice.
Sure. and maybe it does. I'm a terrible piano player. Yeah. But yeah, he definitely knows the limits of the instrument, and I, you know, as any great artist will do, will play to the strengths and find ways to make the limits of the instrument not such limits.
So speaking of sound, Max, something I think that would be interesting, at least I would find it interesting. I mean, I've listened to a lot of Brad Meldow, right? And
you sure have.
But when we're thinking about sound, again, the two settings that I think we might talk most about here are the trio and the solo settings. When you're listening to those recordings, they are approached differently. I mean, I don't know if you necessarily need to talk about recording techniques per se, but can you speak a little bit to the sonic soundscape differences that people can be thinking about or expecting when going into one of his trio recordings versus a solo piano recording, for instance?
Yeah. So I feel like it's, I'm going to try and dance around this because like, I feel like there are some, similarities that like also are differences. Mm. But when you're going into a solo album or recording, you're going to get Brad being able to play, he's going to be able to play more over the full range of the instrument more often. However, Brad being an extremely expressive player with, you know, Romantic era influence is going to have extreme contrast. And so there will be times when he's playing just, you know, just in this like very narrow range and then go to this huge full, using the full range of the piano. But when he's playing with the trio, he's playing with a bass player, right? So he can still play in that low range, but he has to be a lot more careful about it. And one of the things he talks about is being vulnerable with the people that he's playing with, and really, really communicating with them. And that's one of the things, that's one of the dances of like the piano player and the bassist. Mm. Is like, you don't want to get in each other's way.
Right.
And so Brad's very cognizant of that. So, there will be a difference in how he approaches the instrument and his arrangement, like the space on the piano he'll use at different times, depending on what the bass player is doing. And also on the other side, like the drums, like have like cymbals, which is like high end, high frequency stuff. And like a snare drum is like very mid range, like, you know, 200 to 400 hertz or whatever. And that's like in a different place on the piano. So he's like interplaying with the drummer too.
Yeah.
But a lot of the stuff he's doing live too. So from like a recording perspective, you know, they're also like doing it all at the same time. So there aren't overdubs. Perhaps in some of his recordings there are, a lot of his stuff has got like a decent amount of rubato, in it. And so it's really hard to do that to a click.
Yeah.
So there's, that's something that you can look for, I think would be, a valuable and fun exercise to try and pick out.
Yeah. Nice. Well, and you know, you can do that too with that as a foundation in the various other instrumentations that you might hear him in. That's kind of a good platform to launch from, is to be thinking about the you know, sort of the frequency and timbral ranges of the other instruments that the piano has to be not getting in the way of, and vice versa, right?
But with that also, though, he will, like, they will, like, talk back and forth, and they'll, like, mimic each other. Like,
sure.
Someone will do, like, a sharp rhythm, and he'll play a sharp rhythm, you know?
Right.
You know, or, like, a something bright and, like, staccato.
Right.
You know, so there are times when they'll, like, use that as a strength or as a, you know, a feature.
Absolutely. So I guess all said, it's just having that awareness, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, well, and on that point a little bit, too, I do want to address this thing that we've mentioned a couple times of trying to genrefy him, right? So he is oftentimes mentioned or referred to, regarded as one of the great modern jazz pianists. I don't think that's a totally unfair designation, but the reason it gets a little bit tricky is, as an example, a conversation that would get brought up by an educator while I was in school, by a number of different educators, is, you know, they would specifically cite people like Brad Meldow or Keith Jarrett. Those are, like, two piano players that get brought up in this conversation a lot of, you know, if you're looking to learn the bebop tradition of this music, those are not your source materials, right? Like, you don't transcribe Brad Meldow to learn how to play bebop, per se, right? And it's not to say, though, that there isn't a lot of bebop language and sensibility adopted in Brad's playing. He is very, very heavily steeped in the jazz tradition, as we have mentioned a number of times in a lot of different ways. But a lot of what he is doing as an arranger of jazz standards or songs from the Great American Songbook, which is a large part of his repertoire, but also of arrangements that he does of popular tunes, whether it's Stone Temple Pilots or Radiohead or Beatles. In any case, he sort of has his Brad Meldow way of playing those songs, which is to say he has developed such a strong and identifiable voice that is unique to Brad Meldow that it almost doesn't matter in those sorts of playing a song in this improvised tradition sort of a way. It sounds like Brad Meldow. It's not like you're losing the character of the song in the original composition. That's not totally lost. But it's not like he's burning down these bebop lines when he's soloing on these tunes. And what he talks about oftentimes as being his way of thinking about it is having a much more melodic narrative structure in mind to playing over these changes, and not so much thinking about it as what cool hot lick can I play here. It's, here's the general melodic framework that I'm operating on top of right now. What is a melodic device using, you know, underneath that, really clever voice leading and certain ways of modulating between different spaces? Like, how can I just do something that sounds beautiful? And that's more the frame of reference, and not so much like, how hip can this be? That's not to say, though, that he isn't doing some hip sh-.
Sometimes it's too hip, even.
Yeah, I mean, he can get pretty freaky for sure. Like, it's, you know, I say all of that, and it's, there are a lot of very, you know, quote unquote modern improvisational sensibilities that he has, where, yes, perhaps there is some chord change happening here, but the way that you can navigate around that, it can go, like, really an infinite amount of directions. And that's one of the hallmarks, I think, that a lot of people think about with these modern jazz, quote-unquote, giants like Brad Meldow, is what sorts of devices are they using to navigate these chord changes that are a departure from the bebop tradition. So to bring all that in and all that together, there are tons of modern sensibilities to the way that he's playing in every sense of that word, you know, modern meaning harmonically, rhythmically, melodically, you know, there's a lot going on there. Okay. So, without digressing too much in that direction, Max, if you could just kind of put a bow on this, like when you show somebody Brad Meldow, what is kind of the impression that you see that people get? And if that's too far out of a thing to think about, that's okay.
I mean, I think you said it really well. That, like, at the end of the day, he is coming. And actually, this is something like I saw him talk about in an interview. Is at the end of the day, he's coming to, like, steps on stage to play something that is heartfelt and is authentic.
Yeah.
And is going to push himself for that. That's like, he's really trying to make a beautiful piece of music that, in at least in my opinion, he's trying to do that in a way that it'll take you somewhere.
Yeah.
And like really, really suck you in. Because to me, at least, it is an immersive experience. If I let it, there are a few artists that will pull me in the way that Brad Meldow does.
Yeah. Well said. And I think it comes through in his music, and I think that it is demonstrated through the fact that he's not trying to just like burn it down all the time. It's a very deliberate, organic, let's play beautiful music. So who are some people who you think about as being similar to him? All, you know, all of that said, I mean, we're talking about this space that's not quite, it's not quite straight ahead jazz, but there's a lot of, you know, classical romantic sensibility, but there's no abandonment of the jazz tradition per se. Who are some people you think about in that way?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I really do think about Kurt Rosenwinkel.
Yeah.
I think he does a really good job doing something similar. I mean, that's a dumb way to say that, but gosh, let's see. Who do I think of? I think of Robert Glasper.
Mm. Yeah.
Cause he's pulling in different things, and he's definitely, I mean, definitely in a different musical space, but like steeped in the tradition and is trying to make something that will make a statement and like pull you, like, you know, has that jazz tradition but is trying to make a beautiful piece of music. And I think there are a lot of people like that when we approach it from that perspective. I mean, like, yeah, that's a rabbit hole of like who knows the depths of their tradition and then like also does like really cool other things like with that, you know, and pushes boundaries of like, what is this genre?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, and I think for that matter, we could probably mention many of the, you know, modern jazz musicians who we've talked about in previous episodes, you know, like Mark Juliana, like Galad Hexelman,
yeah,
like Chris Potter, mm-hmm. Like Tigran Hamasyan, right? And many others who it's like, yeah, like there's a lot in the jazz tradition that cannot be ignored that's going into their music, but end of the day, they have a very distinct voice in how they're approaching music.
Yeah. I guess like one that came to mind is like the Bad Plus.
Yeah, totally.
You know, mm-hmm. I feel like that's kind of I feel like less of a cop-out answer for me. Like, cause they're kind of doing that, right?
Yeah.
Like, they're playing music that is recognizable, but they're doing it from a different perspective, you know?
Totally.
That's so,
I think that's definitely running in parallel with what's going on with the Meldow Trio. Well, that's a doozy of a rabbit hole. So let's talk about how should you actually get into listening to Brad Meldow with all of this in mind.
100% see him live. Do it. Don't ask questions. Just buy the ticket.
Yeah.
I will say though, his social media presence is pretty nil. it's not great. So
I respect that. He doesn't need to.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. But so check his website. Check his website. Check the ticket vendors. I guess that's what they're called.
Yeah.
The ticketing agencies, whatever. then I mean, see him, like, it's 100% worth your time. Can confirm. We actually saw the same tour in separate places one year.
That's right.
That was kind of cool. But he's got a ton of stuff on YouTube, and whether it's him or other people having recorded it to put it up.
Mm-hmm.
But he definitely has a lot of recorded material that is out there, and people will, I don't know, there's a ton of stuff to consume.
Yeah.
But the albums are great. Check out the albums. We'll give our picks, but there are no bad ones, which I feel like is very fanboy of me to say that, but I do believe it.
Yeah. I'm with you.
Yeah. But, I don't think there's like kind of a cool hip new way to get into him, but what would you recommend, Parker, if you were to,
yeah, I do want a
give
second,
us a, give us
checking out some, okay, deal. Checking out some video footage. Do pull him up on YouTube.
Yeah.
He's
super fun to watch.
Yeah, very pleasant to watch. He's not super eccentric, but he's in a zone. Really great to see.
He is one with the music.
Yes.
It's cool to see.
Uh-huh. As far as recorded picks, though, there, because he has a very sizable discography, so you can throw a dart and just listen, but it's going to be, depending on where the dart lands, it might be rather different from a lot of the other stuff. So I'll give a couple, one that's maybe a bit more predictable and one that's maybe a little bit different. The Art of the Trio collection is some of the most important, you know, jazz albums of the last 30 years, I would contend. One that I go back to often is Volume 3. So that's going to be Art of the Trio, Volume 3. I get a kick out of it every time, but I, you know, they're all great. The other one I'll put one in for is After Bach, where it's an album where he's playing a handful of Bach's compositions, but then for each one, he writes a response piece of sorts it's his own composition, but it's influenced by the Bach piece that he had played previously. So it's solo piano. It's really brilliant. But yeah, again, there's a lot of places you could go. So what would your picks be?
So my first pick is going to be 10 Years Solo Live, which is one of my favorite pieces, like albums ever. It's also 5 hours. So
makes sense.
Yeah, we recorded over the course of 10 years of him playing different solo pieces, and it just is incredible. Yeah. For my second one, I'm going to not say his latest album because it's also solo piano. That's my not pick, but the second actual pick is going to be Meliana, Taming the Dragon.
Cool.
I remember when that came out, and it just blew my mind. Playing with Mark Juliana, he's playing synthesizers. There's actually footage on YouTube of... I wonder if that was my pick for... I think that was my pick, one of my picks for Mark Juliana.
It was.
Too.
I was just going to say, I think this is a first double selection.
Is that cheating? Like, if that's not okay, then I'll go with
I think the Beatles album. I think it says something, man. That's cool. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, there's they played it live, and there's recordings of all of it played live.
Super
and
cool.
Some songs that are not on the album. Yeah. You find those on YouTube, and it'll blow your freaking mind. So
get on that.
Check if you did not check that out, this is you darn well better now.
Well, we're big fans, it's kind of a fanboy episode in a lot of different ways for both of us.
But a deserved one.
Absolutely. He is without question will go down as one of the greats. He is one of the living greats. Well worth your time. It's not hard to like get into it. It's just great music. So without further ado, this is our defense of Brad Meldow. Modern jazz has a number of heroes whose landing on the scene continues to ripple with considerable magnitude. Amongst those who seem to affect players on an ongoing basis is Brad Meldow. Something about his evolving yet perspicacious relationship to composition and improvisation through the last 30 years has made people excited about improvised music and has inspired a generation of players and composers spanning the genre spectrum. But why? What is it about Meldow's ideas that is so captivating to eager minds?
One of his strengths can certainly be attributed to a rich connection with tradition. In both jazz and classical domains, Meldow has devoted years of study and emulation. Sensibilities of both jazz piano greats and classical composition giants, particularly the German Romantics, are interwoven into a seamless tapestry of effortless voice leading, spontaneous counterpoint, tremendous facility, and broad dexterity with his left and right hands alike. These broader technical observations pull in many elements from the bebop language, but tend to steer away from lick-driven ideas in favor of a melodic narrative form that begins to explain the unique voice he wields.
Meldow does not by any means shy away from the crucial discussion of knowing tradition and lineage, nor does he preclude the equally necessary discussion of carving one's own path and developing a voice. By no means are these separate matters. Most argue that the latter is rather impossible without the former. But he does make mention of the utility of simply forming a relationship with your instrument that is organic. Of course, absorb the wisdom of the greats, but then allow those lessons to manifest in whatever the synthesis of that information pushes out through your hands. He is many things as a player, and it's no wonder he is so studied. But if we're to learn from how he has achieved the status that he has, it would be to log that information in your brain and then work to find your thing. And then you'll sound like, well, you.
So thanks for listening. Brad Meldow is absolutely a favorite of ours. I mean, if you didn't pick that up, I mean,
easy.
It's this is an episode we've been really, really stoked on. And I can't say enough at how fun of a rabbit hole it is.
Yeah.
If something isn't like just, you know, scratching the itch, move on to something else and come back, because there's a lot of different stuff. And I mean, all but guarantee that there is something that there is going that is just going to suck you in.
Yeah.
And really, really captivate you. So we hope you check him out. We really hope that you find something of his that speaks to you and that you enjoy. And check him out live. But let us know what your experience is, and let us know if there's stuff about Brad Meldow that we did not cover, because there is quite a lot. We would love to talk with you about it. So you can send us an email at themusiciansmusicianpodcast@gmail.com. You can hit us up on social media at TMMPod on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And you can go to our website, www.tmmpod.com, where you can listen to episodes, read the defense of the artist, check out our picks, and even donate to the growth of the podcast. So we hope you love Brad Meldow's music. And until next time, thanks.